I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. This year, we've seen what many experts agree are real symptoms of global warming, from forest fires that are raging in Colorado to the drought that is devastating the Midwest. And a new study that is actually funded by the conservative Koch brothers has even the most skeptical folks warming up to the reality of man-made climate change. And here with me in Studio 3 is someone who thinks a lot about global warming, Dan Schrag. He's the professor of geology at Harvard University, where he's also the director of the Center for the Environment. Dan Schrag, thanks for being here.
Good afternoon.
So I know you actually look at climate on a really, really large scale. We're talking millions and billions of years. And when you look at the past 5, 10, 20 years against all that data, do these few years stand out?
Well, these few years, the last decade or so, is particularly unusual. Not in the longer context of geologic history. There have been very, very warm climates in Earth history, and there have been very, very cold climates in Earth history. We're supposed to be in relatively a cold climate today, but that appears to be changing very quickly.
And you know, you said there have been very warm climates and very cold climates. How have humans done navigating the very warm climates and the very cold climates that we've seen in the past?
Well, most of human civilization has been in one climate, what we call an interglacial period, the last 10,000 years or the Holocene. Humans and their ancestors lived through many other climates. There have been periodic fluctuations between the ice ages, and then what we call the interglacials over the last several million years. And so all of our descendants, all of our ancestors lived through those climate changes. But the big difference is time scale. Those climate changes occurred over 10,000 years. So the transition, you know, here we are in Boston, we were covered by a big ice sheet a mile thick 10,000 or 20,000 years ago. That change, that melting of the ice sheet and that transition took 10,000 years. And that's a lot of time for both humans and the natural world to adapt. What's happening now is happening really quickly. It's really over a century or so.
And has that ever happened before, that things are happening so quickly?
You know, there is really no good geologic analog for what's happening today. There are a few other time intervals when there was a very rapid warming event, but the last one was about 55 million years ago, and it occurred very quickly, but it probably was still at least orders of magnitude slower than what we're experiencing today.
So what happens to the natural world, including people, if things change so quickly that you're not able to migrate out of your environment? And this includes like trees, right, that might shift north or south depending. What happens when it happens so fast?
That's a really good question. So humans are amazingly adaptable. We're pretty good. We can go buy air conditioners. We can, you know, buy snow plows if it snows too much in the winter. We can adapt to changing climate pretty quickly. Natural systems are not so good at that, and we're seeing massive change. If you go to the western U.S., I was out in Colorado this summer. Not only is it incredibly dry, but you see dead pine trees all over the place. That's from beetle kill, from the beetles that normally would be killed off in the wintertime, but because of the warm winter, they've lived through, and it's caused an explosion of the beetles that are ultimately killing all the trees.
We've also got on the phone Bill McKibben, an environmentalist and an author and a journalist who has written extensively on this issue. And Bill McKibben, thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure as always.
So you wrote a very popular piece in Rolling Stone recently, and you sort of paint a very dire picture, which I'm going to get to. But since we're talking about people and nature adapting, and you're in Vermont, just tell me sort of in the span of your life, which is obviously short in geologic time, what have you seen in terms of the environment around you changing?
Very polite of you to put it that way. That's older people like to be compared to the age of the universe. Look, we see both subtle changes that have happened. Winter is many weeks shorter on average than it was. We can tell that by things like ice out dates on the lakes and things like that. We also see disruptive weather events of a kind we've never seen before, and that are, you know, not really impossible to adapt to in the way that we're used to thinking about. In Vermont, the great example would be Hurricane Irene last fall, dumped more water than we've ever seen in this state, washed half the state away. We're still rebuilding roads and bridges. Our governor said the next morning, said, you know what, I did not run to be governor of a tropical nation. This is not what Vermont's supposed to be like, and he is absolutely right. So, you know, there's change that we can try to adapt to. We have to adapt to that which we can't prevent. We've already raised the temperature a degree, and, you know, another degree is pretty darn likely. But we have to work even harder to prevent that to which we cannot adapt, and that's why we do so much work to try and bring the fossil fuel industry to heal and to, you know, actually get climate change under, not to end it, that's not possible anymore, but to get it under some kind of control.
Dan Tragg, did you want to get in here?
Well, I think Bill's exactly right. I think though that, you know, the reason we're having this conversation right now is because even with all of these unusual events, including Hurricane Irene last summer and all of the strange weather over the last decade and the overall warming and the melting of the ice sheets and the disappearance of the Arctic ice cap, this year in the U.S., we've witnessed some weather events that make climate scientists like me really scratch our heads. We don't understand this system. And that's really, I think, a very important message, which is we are not just monkeying, we are profoundly altering a system that we don't understand. And it's a very powerful system that we're messing with.
What events this year have made you scratch your head?
Well, there was one event that most people really enjoyed. It didn't hurt anybody, at least directly. It will hurt people ultimately. But this March, we had a heat wave in the U.S., the likes of which nobody has ever seen before. It looks like it's something like a 1-in-1,000-year event, except that statistics are no longer terribly useful because the statistics assume that things are stationary and things are changing so fast that they're not very, very useful. We had amazing things. In the Midwest, in Minnesota, overnight low temperatures were setting records, breaking all-time highs.
For daytime temperatures.
North Dakota hit 94 degrees 2 days before the end of winter. And it was unbelievable.
And, you know, in New Brunswick, in St. John, New Brunswick, you had temperature records being set for all of April in mid-March. I mean, this was extraordinary. In Michigan, temperature records were being broken by 30 degrees Fahrenheit. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And frankly, statistically, you would predict this really shouldn't happen ever. And yet it did. And we still don't understand exactly why. We're beginning to put together some of the reasons. But the point is that it begins to make us think that the system is behaving in a much more complicated and less predictable way. And it also emphasizes just how bad things could get. The impact of that heat wave, followed by a dry spring and very low snowfall over the winter, has been this incredible drought that's hurting corn and soybean farmers and ultimately the cattle industry as well.
Right.
And it's a huge impact. I was out in Colorado. There was less than, you know, just a few percent of the normal snow cover that was there. Really incredible.
Bill McKibben, you know, you say that we can maybe tolerate 2 degrees centigrade, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature. And that would mean, so here's the interesting math I think that you lay out, but kind of scary math. That would mean that we could dump 565 gigatons of carbon more into the atmosphere. And tell me about that number and what we're on track to do.
Here's the problem. I mean, in the first place, 2 degrees is not a good number. It's what the world has said is the most we could possibly raise the temperature without catastrophe. We'd be smart, very smart, to stop well short of it for the reasons you've been hearing right now. Second thing, yes, you're right. 565 more gigatons will get us there. Here's the dangerous number, the one that made this Rolling Stone piece go viral. It turns out that the fossil fuel industry has 2,795 gigatons of coal, gas, and oil, the carbon, in their reserves, ready to go. Now, it's still below ground, but it's economically above ground. That's what their share price is based on. That's what they borrow money against. And it means that unless things change fast, unless we change the rules of the game dramatically and quickly, that's going to get burnt, and we're going to go into absolutely uncharted territory. I mean, you know, this summer is what climate change feels like in its early stages. But, you know, early is the operative word. We've got very little time to get this under any kind of control.
Dan Tragg, do people in the scientific community, the people you talk to, do they sort of throw their hands up? Do they think, are they motivated and saying, let's try to, you know, change policy? What's the feeling?
I just spent a week with 20 young postdoctoral scientists, young scholars in the climate field who are just getting into their, starting their careers. They're starting faculty positions at universities all over the country. And I've got to say, I think we had a discussion of exactly this topic, and they're very motivated. They want to understand the system. They realize that this really affects people and the natural world, and they want to understand it. Of course, it's a little depressing because you can understand it, but you're watching really amazing things happen that are going to ultimately have a terrible impact on society. My colleague, John Holdren, who's now President Obama's science advisor, like to say that there are only three things we can do about climate change. We can mitigate it or try to prevent it. We can adapt to it, or we can suffer. And we're likely to do some of all three. You know, and this, I view this 2-degree number that you quoted, and I agree with Bill on this, that's just an arbitrary thing that really the Europeans have picked as the safe level. But there's nothing safe about it at all. The truth is that it's just a question of how much suffering are we going to do. And what this summer and the heat wave last spring told us was that we have a little more suffering in store than we thought.
And are there parts of the world that are particularly upset about the way that climate is changing, parts of the world that are being disproportionately affected?
Well, I think for a long time, the public had the view that this was really about poor countries, that it was poor countries who couldn't adapt to climate change that were going to suffer the most. Low-lying islands in the Pacific that were going to get submerged. And there are certainly uneven impacts. No question, low-lying countries like Bangladesh, for example, is going to be hit really hard by sea level rise. But so is Shanghai, and so is New York, and so is Boston, and so is Los Angeles. And so we got to remember that and I think the heat wave this summer and the impact on our crops, or what happened in 2010 in Russia, where they lost a third of their wheat harvest because of a huge heat wave. I think the lesson is that the impacts, although they are uneven and there are certainly poor countries will suffer a lot, that rich countries are going to suffer too.
Bill McKibben, Dan Tragg says that, you know, New York and Shanghai and LA are going to suffer. Do you think that those cities have buckled in and really understand what they're about to experience potentially?
No, of course not. You know, it's too much to ask them to do it, and it's too much to, I mean, you know, they're starting to try, and people beginning to come up with plans, but we're going to be racing behind until we get ahead of the problem on a kind of national and global basis. I mean, Dan's absolutely right, and you can really get a sense of how fast things are changing if you look not just at the U.S. this summer, but you look at what's going on Greenland, the biggest block of ice outside the Antarctic and one that holds the key to an awful lot of what our fate's going to look like. The news from there is the most unsettling of all, as melt proceeds at a pace we've never seen before, as the very albedo, the reflectivity of that great ice sheet darkens perceptibly week after week after week. Time to address this on a really serious level. 350.org is launching a nationwide tour, 20 cities in 20 days, the night after the election. And the point of that tour is going to be, we've got to start organizing now. We've got to have a movement that looks like the one that brought down, you know, helped bring down apartheid on American college campuses a generation ago. The fossil fuel industry is what stands in the way above all. They're the ones who warp our political system. They're taking away our future and our planet. We're going to have to figure out how to take away their money. And we're going to have to do it fast.
I want to talk about this notion of activism. Let me first say, I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and we're talking about global warming with Dan Tragg, professor of geology at Harvard, and Bill McKibben, environmentalist, author, and journalist. And let's first talk about the sort of political state of this debate on global warming. Dan Tragg, I know oh, maybe 5-6 years ago, you testified before the Senate on this, and you talked about speaking in front of Oklahoma Republican Senator James Inhofe. And I'm going to play a little clip of him. This was this spring, and he's talking to Rachel Maddow on MSNBC about the cost of implementing climate legislation. Let's listen.
Back during the time that we were looking at Kyoto, then we had the McCain-Lieberman bill, we had all these cap-and-trade bills, the cost is to the American taxpayers would be between $300 and $400 billion a year. Now, Rachel, if you look at that, go back to what I thought was the biggest tax increase in three decades, the Clinton-Gore tax increase of 1993. This would be 10 times that great. Do you realize I was actually on your side of this issue when I was chairing that committee and I first heard about this? I thought it must be true until I found out what it cost. When I started questioning the science, our phone was ringing off the hook in my office in Washington by scientists who said that they were rejected from the process because they didn't agree with the conclusion.
Okay, Dan Schrag, a couple of issues that he raises here. One is the central issue really money, and that it would cost so much to try to address climate change that people just don't want to do it?
Well, I think that's one of the issues. I think there's no question that it's expensive, although not nearly as expensive as Senator Inhofe said. You know, $300 or $400 billion might be the ultimate cost, $300-400 billion a year to solve the whole problem, not to take a little first step like any of the bills he was talking about. I think the issue ultimately is not only money. I think people... climate change asks us to reconsider our entire way of life, dealing with it responsibly. I mean, think about it. Every car we drive is based on fossil fuels. Our entire system of our economy is based on fossil fuels. There are alternatives, but we're not used to them, and it's a big, big change. Some people have compared climate change to getting rid of tobacco and smoking. It's nothing like that. This is far deeper and more profound in our society. And it's not surprising that certainly the industries that might be threatened by this have put up a very stiff resistance.
And Bill McKibben, the question is, do people want to pay extra money? I mean, sure, there are people, for example, who have Priuses, but that's about 3% of the cars in America. So, you know, how do you address this if there's money involved and we're not in a great economic time?
Well, the first thing to be said is, were there any kind of actual accounting, we'd all be eager to buy Priuses. If carbon was forced to pay the damage it does in the atmosphere, we'd be lining up. The fossil fuel industry is the only industry on the planet that does not have to pay to put its waste out. They have the greatest special break of all time. And that's why they fight so hard to defend it. It's why they send people like Jim Inhofe to the Senate. It's why they're the biggest donors in our campaign system, to defend the greatest perk of all time. Now, we could take away that perk without bankrupting ourselves. We could put a heavy tax on carbon, or the price at the pump would go up, and we could take that money that we collected and just rebate it straight to Americans. People call it a fee and dividend system, and they're putting versions of it in place in places like Australia. We could do that. If we did, it would be over the belligerent objections of the fossil fuel industry, because they're making more money than any industry in history has ever made right now. That's why we're going to try and go after them hard. We need to kind of soften them up. We need to make people understand that they have become a rogue industry. They're not an outlaw industry against the laws of the United States, because they get to write those laws pretty much, but they're an outlaw industry against the laws of physics and chemistry. And if we can kind of get people to understand that, then some of the political equation that's kept folks like Jim Inhofe as the most powerful voices on energy in Washington may begin to change.
Dan Schrag.
Well, I agree with Bill that the activism that he does is a really important component of a solution. I actually also work with industry, because we've got to also remember that energy is a very important part of our lives, and these huge companies actually provide a lot of service to us. And it's a complicated issue. One important component of change is an investment in research and development for technology, because ultimately technology is an important part of a solution. Asking people to do without cars completely is very unlikely. Asking people to drive cars that work very well but don't use petroleum is a much more plausible scenario.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's why it's such a shame, say, that ExxonMobil spends $100 million a day exploring for new hydrocarbons that we can't afford to burn, instead of being one of the leaders in taking us in this new direction. And it's possible to go in that new direction. You want one happy statistic amidst these glum ones?
Sure.
One day last month, Germany managed to produce more than half the power it consumed from solar panels within its borders. Now, you know, Munich's north of Montreal. This is proof that what we're looking at is not technological impossibility, but a shortage of political will. And the good news, and Dan is, does a better job than just anyone at trying to change this reality, the good news is political will we can muster, you know, and that's where the fight's going to be.
I do want to talk a little more about political will. We are talking about global warming, and I'm speaking with Dan Tragg and Bill McKibben. Dan Tragg is a professor of geology at Harvard, where he's also the director of the Center for the Environment. And Bill McKibben is an environmentalist and journalist. His latest piece for Rolling Stone magazine is titled Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. I'm Kara Miller. The global warming conversation continues here on Boston Public Radio.
Playwright, director, and actor Afa Fugard is best known for plays that dramatize the harsh realities of apartheid-era South Africa. And even though apartheid is over and he's in his 80s, he finds he still has a lot to say.
I have a greater sense of adventure at this moment in my life than I ever had in the past.
South Africa's Afa Fugard is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Boston Speaker Series, 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes 2 former presidents, a New York Times best-selling author, a miracle survival story, and much more. BostonSpeakersSeries.org. And Aviv Centers for Living, committed to providing the rehabilitation care you need for the results you want. Aviv will open a new campus in Peabody in the fall. For more information, you can visit avivliving.org.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking about global warming and the very real symptoms that we're seeing play out right now across the world. Here with me in Studio 3 is Dan Tragg, a professor of geology at Harvard, where he's also the director of the Center for the Environment. And on the line from Vermont is Bill McKibben, a journalist and environmentalist. And his latest piece for Rolling Stone magazine is titled Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. So I want to go back, Dan Tragg, you mentioned it's really important to have money for research and development for new fuels. I actually talked just a few months ago to Richard Lester from MIT, who is very into thinking about what sort of the next fuels will be. And he said that, you know, somehow, and he didn't quite know how, in Washington, the topic of global warming had become so untouchable that you almost couldn't weigh in on whether you believed it was a fact or not a fact. How'd that happen?
Well, I think probably the most important explanation is just the recession. You know, when people are hurting, they don't want to hear about additional problems that'll cost them money. But, you know, there's some good news that comes out of this in the energy front that I think are, you know, a couple of things to note that are really important. One is that the price of solar panels, which used to be incredibly expensive, something like $8 or $10 a watt. People dreamed of the day when it might get below a dollar a watt. We've actually gotten there now, mostly because of very cheap manufacturing in China. But the truth is that now new solar panels cost something like below a dollar a watt, or at least around a dollar a watt.
But do you see people plastering their roofs with solar panels?
Not yet. And that's because they're still more expensive than burning coal and turning it into electricity. We don't pay for other externalities with coal either, like conventional air pollution, which is very, very important. Another important thing is that, you know, windmills in Iowa, during the recession, while nobody was noticing, Iowa now is the same as Denmark. It has more than 20% wind generation. That's incredible. That happened overnight. And now farmers are just putting up windmills because they see their neighbors making money. And it's so much wind that actually Iowa is kind of a test bed for figuring out how to deal with the intermittency of wind. It's a wonderfully important problem, and hopefully Iowa will figure it out for the rest of us. But that's a very optimistic sign. This is, we are moving towards a solution. We are getting closer to having renewables costing closer to what fossil fuels cost. Of course, the problem is that fossil fuels keep getting cheaper. We keep finding better, more efficient ways of getting fossil fuels out of the ground. And that means that, you know, it's a moving target for the renewables industry.
Which may lead to the issue of a carbon tax. But let's stay on this point for a moment, that it's hard to get, at least in the media, people beyond, on one hand, climate change, on the other, not. I'm going to play a clip for you, Bill McKibben. First, you'll hear E.J. Dionne on ABC's This Week. This is just last month, and he's talking about the really hot and, as you were saying, record-breaking summer that we're having right now.
During heat waves, belief in global warming goes up, surprise, surprise, in the polls. But what we've really seen is wild weather, not only here, but all over the world. And what I don't understand is why people are so resistant, why my conservative friends are so resistant in taking out an insurance policy. There is a lot of evidence that human activity is changing the climate. There's not a lot of dispute among scientists about this. Why wouldn't we want to take out an insurance policy to protect ourselves? Because if we go wrong on this, we're making an awfully big mistake.
And then Bill McKibben, commentator George Will, came in. He doesn't believe in global warming, and he responds to what E.J. Dionne said.
How do we explain the heat? One word, summer. What is so unusual about this? Now, come the winter, there will be a cold snap and lots of snow, and the same guys like EJ will start lecturing us. There's a difference between the weather and the climate. I agree with that. We're having some hot weather. Get over it.
Bill McKibben, what do you say when somebody says, listen, this is weather, get over it? And that's also where we are very much in the media, it feels like, on the one hand, on the other hand.
Look, the media has not covered itself with glory in covering climate change. And that, you know, people like George will feel free to just kind of spout off stuff that is, at this point, scientific nonsense is sad. I got to say, it's not making much difference anymore. People don't need the media anymore to tell them what's going on. They can look around them and see, you know, this world is changing at a remarkably rapid clip. People who follow the price of grain, people who follow the weather, people who live near the ocean and know that it's 30% more acid than it was 3 years ago. Everybody is starting to figure it out. I'm afraid in this case, you know, the pundit class is going to be a lagging indicator, not a leading one. But the day will come when we build a movement, and I think it's not that far away, strong enough to really take on the fossil fuel industry. And then all these guys who basically just wait for their instructions from, you know, GOP headquarters, which is pretty much fossil fuel funded, they'll, you know, change their tune in whatever direction the wind is blowing. The trouble is the wind's going to be blowing harder because it's going to be hotter out.
Let me push back on that a little bit.
Sure.
Not that long ago, I talked to Minor Sinclair, who works at Oxfam America, and he has been down helping a lot with people who are trying to recover from Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf Coast. And one of the things that he said when I asked him, you know, do people attribute this in that area? Do people attribute it to global warming? He said, you know, some people do. And a lot of people, for ideological reasons, don't believe in global warming. They sort of think of it as a terrible event that struck them. And all these events are, you know, sad events, but they don't think of it as part of anything.
As things mount up, the polling evidence is showing that a much higher percentage of Americans is now worried about climate change. And it's no wonder. I mean, 80% of American counties were into some kind of declared disaster area last year. There were more billion-dollar disasters than any year in American history. This year, as Dan points out, we've already had summer in March. We've had some of the most epic heat waves the planet's ever seen. We're locked in a wicked drought that's clearly going to raise the price of food. And, you know, more than half the nation's counties, as of this morning, are in declared disaster areas. Look, it's possible that we'll just figure out some way to ignore it all and go back to watching the Kardashians or whatever. But I think it's pretty clear that something is starting to change. People really are understanding that we better take some action. It hasn't yet become an issue in the presidential election. We'll see if it does. But we're right on the edge of that kind of thing.
Dan Tregg, yeah, what do you see happening when you look forward?
Well, a couple of things that are worth noting. One is that, you know, in terms of government taking it seriously, there are parts of government that take it very seriously. The military is actually thinking about climate change in a serious way. They're also thinking about energy conservation and transitions in energy in a serious way because they felt that they have led the country in the past and they understand their role in leading the country in the future. So that's something to watch. You know, the George Will's statements aside, the fact is the Pentagon takes climate change very seriously because they think it's important. And they think an insurance policy is a very useful thing.
So we have seen President Obama really support fracking and more mining. I mean, he has supported other things, too, like increased mileage standards for cars, but it doesn't necessarily seem consistent across the board.
You know, it's a very complicated thing. The truth is that although changes in our energy system are essential, we are so dependent on oil and gas that we're not going to get rid of them in the next 2 years. The systems we build are incredibly expensive. Even a single power plant can cost several billion dollars. And so this transition is going to take decades. That's frustrating as we watch the climate change, but it's also true that it's unlikely that people are going to be willing to spend so much money to basically just get rid of all of the old infrastructure, throw their cars away, and buy electric cars. The transition is going to happen, hopefully, but it'll happen slowly. And in that context, as a president, it's difficult. You have to do a variety of things that are important, both with the current energy system and the future one.
What do you see happening? Bill McKibben points out in Rolling Stone that you add together the U.S. and China, and right there, two countries out of all the countries in the world, right there you're at 40% of emissions. China has now overtaken the U.S. It was the U.S. for a long, long time, the leader in emissions. But China is obviously growing fast. A lot of people are entering the middle class, and they've now overtaken us.
You know, I was in China last year on a special delegation to talk with our counterparts about climate. The Chinese are actually much more worried about climate change than we are. They're very aware that in the past, Chinese governments have been overthrown by peasant revolutions. They're very worried about food production and drought in China and water supply. And they're very smart about technology. They've been building more efficient plants, and they're doing a lot. Are they doing enough? No. But they're doing a lot compared to what we're doing. I think the truth is that it's true that two countries represent 40% or so of the world's emissions. That's both good news and bad news. The good news is that, in fact, you don't need to have 200 countries in the room to figure out how to solve this problem. If China and the U.S. actually agreed to get serious and they really wanted to solve this problem, the rest of the world would follow. And that's the good part of this. If this were really, if you really needed to get 100 countries to solve this problem, it would be a much more difficult one. You need to get two big ones and a bunch of other medium-sized ones.
But it's hard to convince those two countries.
It is hard to convince these two countries. It's hard to convince this country. But I think we were almost there in the last presidential election when both presidential candidates, McCain and Obama, agreed that this was a serious problem. McCain has since reversed himself with pressure from the right. When Larry Summers was president of Harvard, you know, former Treasury Secretary, Larry said to me, you know, action on climate change in Washington is going to take a very long time, a lot longer than people think. But when it comes, it's going to come very quickly. And our job is to be prepared so that we know what to do when the political will is there. And I think there's a lot of wisdom there. I think, you know, with Bill McKibben continuing the pressure through activism and with a variety of other activities going on politically, I think it's very important to be ready because we don't know when things could flip. The truth is that most of the public does believe in climate change. Most of the public is concerned about climate change. They're just more concerned about healthcare. They're more concerned about their jobs. And that's understandable. But at some point, that this may jump to the top of the agenda once again.
Bill McKibben, let's talk about that activism. And I think what's really the interesting component of what you want to do is sort of start a campaign that resembles the campaign against apartheid in the 1980s. Talk about what that campaign would look like.
Well, look, of course, the people who really fought that campaign hardest were the people in South Africa who liberated themselves. But when he got out of jail, Nelson Mandela came to California, and the first place he went was the University of California, where students had forced the divestiture of $3 billion in stock tainted by its ties to that racist regime. And he said, "We could not have done this without you." We're going to try and employ some of that same logic. It does not make sense for universities to be funding the education of their students with investments in companies whose business plans rule out the possibility of a workable planet on which to enact that education. It does not make sense for pension funds to be putting their people's retirement money in companies whose business plan dictates they won't have a workable planet to retire on. Look, it's pretty clear by now that the only thing these guys care about is money. Rex Tillerson, the CEO of Exxon, said 2 weeks ago, you know what, my predecessors were not telling you the truth. In fact, global warming is real. But it's an engineering problem with engineering solutions. And asked for an example, he said, well, if we need to move our crop production areas, we will. Crazy talk. Our crop production areas are what other people call farms, and there's actually no place to move them to. You can't uproot Iowa because it's gotten too hot to grow things there and put it on the Arctic tundra because there's no topsoil. What we need to do is not have every farmer in the world adapt. What we need to do is have Exxon adapt its business plan, and Chevron and ConocoPhillips and Peabody Coal and everybody else. They've got to keep 80% of the reserves they've got now underground, because we clearly can't burn any more of that. That's the burden of the math in this piece that I just wrote. We've got to keep most of that underground, and that's what the fight's about. These guys are willing, in fact, eager to alter the atmosphere of the climate if they can make a few more years of record profits. It's the most radical thing that humans have ever engaged in.
And do you see students being either willing or able to get, you know, Yale and Harvard, you know, like you said, the University of California system to say, forget ExxonMobil. It may seem like it has a good, you know, price earnings ratio, but we are not interested.
We'll find out. You know, people never believe that anyone can change anything until they do. This time last year, everybody told us we were nuts to try taking on this Keystone Pipeline down out of the tar sands of Canada. But we said, look, it's the second biggest pool of carbon on the planet. We've got to try. We ended up having the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years in this country, 1,253 people arrested at the White House, and a few weeks later, ringed the White House with tens of thousands of people. And a few days after that, the Obama administration said, okay, we'll take another look at it. Now, I don't know whether we're going to win more than a temporary victory there. The fossil fuel industry is fighting back hard. But we've demonstrated that we can begin to stand up to these guys. We're going to have to stand up to them a lot more. I don't know whether... Look, if you're asking me for prediction about whether we're going to win this whole fight or not, I got to tell you, the science is kind of dark right now. The only thing that can change the equation is the mustering of a lot of political will in a very short period of time. That's what movements are about. That's what we're going to try. If you want to help, come by 350.org.
Dan Tragg, can you imagine the divestiture of fossil fuel companies coming to Harvard Yard?
I actually can imagine that. I actually think if
you can,
if you actually,
okay.
Absolutely. I think if there is a topic ripe for student activism, this is certainly one of them. And I think Bill's caught on to something important here. A complication is that, unlike apartheid, which could end so abruptly, the timescale of change in this one makes it very difficult. It's hard to say, what is it exactly that you're fighting for? You know, fighting for some legislation that is cap and trade, that's not very satisfying. So it's a little bit of difficult that way. You know, a sobering perspective is one that my colleague Andy Hoffman at the University of Michigan has talked about. He compares thinking about climate change today in the U.S. to thinking about slavery in the 18th century in London, where if you said to somebody, I want to get rid of slaves, get rid of slavery, they would have said, you're crazy. Our whole economy depends on slavery. What are you talking about? And that's what it feels like talking about getting rid of fossil fuels today. It took a long time to get rid of slavery. And
that's, you know, Dan's exactly right. And the only problem is that in this case, unlike slavery or something else, the time isn't being set in by human, according to human dictates. It would be very nice to have a long time. And I have no doubt that given a century, we could get off fossil fuel easily, gradually, comfortably, and onto something else. The problem, as he knows, of course, is better than anyone, is that physics and chemistry are forcing the pace. And given the science of this past year, I mean, it looks like the window in which we have to operate is narrower, and hence the actions we need bolder all the time.
There's one other component of this that I think is important to put out there, which is the timescale of climate change. Most people don't think about this. You know, we're so focused on human timescales, what's going to happen in the next 20 years, 50 years, or maybe 100 years. But here's the important thing, that a lot, maybe 20 or 30% of the CO2 we put in the air is going to be there tens of thousands of years from now. So the decisions we make in the next few generations are going to be affecting the Earth for tens of thousands of years. That's, for me, we don't even know how to think about that.
Yeah, it's hard for people to think that long term, I think,
and
kind of,
you know,
scale.
I'm a geologist, so I do think about those timescales, but the truth is, that's really troubling. And it turns out there's a lot of clarity that comes from those timescales. Over those timescales, it's not a question of how fast Greenland's going to melt. Greenland is gone. You know, sea level, it's not a question of exactly how much. It's going to be tens of meters of sea level rise over those timescales. We are committing future generations to a pace of climate change that we wouldn't tolerate for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we are really enforcing this on the future, not just of our grandchildren, but of our children's children's children for thousands of generations.
Not to mention every other species on the planet.
That's right.
And before, very, very, very good point.
Before we wrap up, I want to check in with WGBH science reporter Heather Goldstone, who has done a lot of reporting on the effects of climate change in this local area. Heather, where are you seeing the particular effects of global warming in Massachusetts?
I'll be honest with you, and I think you've already heard this from your other two guests, that when you really start to look around and become aware of the science, it's hard not to see global warming having an impact almost everywhere. But I'll just mention a couple here in southeastern Massachusetts. Migratory birds are showing up, many of them showing up to 9 days earlier. So all it takes is maybe a pair of binoculars and looking out at your back bird feeder to start seeing the impacts of global warming there. Things like purple finches and turkey vultures didn't used to winter on Cape Cod and are now seen fairly commonly. That may not sound that bad. It's just a change in which birds are around, and that's fine. We're also seeing a lot of changes in ocean life. And given our dependence on fisheries here in Massachusetts, that could start to have some major economic impacts. The lobster populations south and west of Cape Cod, so Buzzards Bay, Narragansett Bay, Long Island Sound, that whole area, populations in the past 10 years have really just collapsed. And the major culprit appears to be rising water temperatures. Water temperatures during the summer have just hit a threshold that the lobsters can no longer tolerate. And it looks like that could cause essentially the collapse of that historic fishery. We're also seeing over half of all other commercially exploited fish species moving to try to stay in their comfort zones. We could, by 2050, even see a Georgia's Bank that is too warm for cod. Believe it or not, you know, Cape Cod named after cod, and we may have waters that are too warm for cod within the next few decades. So I think there are a lot of impacts, you know, that can be seen. It just requires opening one's eyes and paying attention to a little bit of the science that's out there.
And do people in the industries, let's say in the fisheries industry or even in the tourism industry, if we're talking about, you know, the change in beaches and the change in water, do people connect this to global warming, or do they think of it sort of separately and economically?
That's a really good question, and I think it really depends on the industry, and at this point just depends from person to person. Out in the Pacific Northwest, oyster growers are very, very concerned about the increase in ocean acidity, which I believe you mentioned earlier. As carbon dioxide is absorbed by the ocean, it actually increases the acidity of the ocean. The ocean is now 30% more acidic than it was 200 years ago, and that makes it really hard for oysters and other shellfish to actually build their shells. And out in the Pacific Northwest, they've had failing oyster populations that they've really had to start figuring out how to re-engineer their hatcheries and get their oyster growers back on track. We haven't seen that same degree of impact here, and so oyster farmers on the Cape and in Massachusetts are kind of, this seems to be something that's just hitting their horizon. A lot of fishermen are still saying, oh, well, we think we're seeing more impacts from overfishing than we are from global warming at this point. But I think it is something that's starting to enter people's minds, and as you said, especially with things like rising sea level and how that's going to exacerbate erosion issues that we already have, certainly that is starting to weigh on the minds of planners and business people around the Cape and other coastal areas.
It's really interesting. You see the impacts globally, and we see them locally. We've been talking about global warming, and I've been speaking with WGBH science reporter Heather Goldstone, journalist, author, and environmental activist Bill McKibben, whose latest piece for Rolling Stone magazine is entitled Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, and Harvard geology professor Daniel Schrag, who is also the director of the Center for the Environment. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care, y'all.
So what Massachusetts town was settled by Puritans in 1635 became fertile ground for the Transcendentalists in the 1830s, and by the 1960s was a place where no-nonsense women mended swimsuits and served baked Cheerios with their cocktails? My guest writer Sarah Payne Stewart, who has a recent piece in The New Yorker, will bring you that answer. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.